Evening, everyone. My name's Matt and I'm an addict. Hi. I'd like to ask Ewan to come and introduce the main speaker for the evening. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name's Kieran. I'm an addict. It's quite a good night tonight, isn't it? Everyone having a good time? Well, I've been asked to come up here and say a couple of things about a dear friend of mine who's going to be speaking for you tonight. I met this man a little over 7 years ago. It was a treatment centre that I was starting to go to that this man was working at. And what he used to do was, little did I know, but he was holding these sort of mini CA groups at this treatment centre. So I went to the first one, and someone from our fellowship, who this man had invited up to do it, it was all very hush-hush because he weren't meant to be talking about this in his workplace. He weren't meant to be talking about the 12-step, but thank God he did. And this man was speaking about the programme and the steps, and that's what caught me. And Paul, who's going to be speaking for you tonight, was taking this group, and we got talking after. And from that point in my life, it's been a pivotal part of my recovery. And he's been a rock for me throughout. What Paul does and continues to do, which I look up to, you know, he don't just come and talk a bit and go home and not do anything about it. Paul is continually working his stuff. He practices what he preaches. He's continually in this program and he helps. I mean, it must be thousands and thousands of people. It's got to be. It has to be, you know, and that is no mean feat, you know, and thank God the likes of Paul is in our fellowship. And he's been around for years, you know, carrying the message and doing it with a smile on his face. And that's what it's all about, man. Happy, joyous and free. And it gives me great pleasure and it's a privilege to introduce the man, Paul Gamble.
I can see. Yes, please, Matt. My name's Paul and I'm an addict. All right? Yeah? Can you hear me? Cool. Yeah, just want to say thank you for Kieran introducing me and all that stuff and making me go red. You know, thank you for the convention committee putting this on. You know how really hard it is to get something like this going and trying to please others and give them a little round of applause for their service. And because I've sat in them group consciences for 4 hours and want to leave CA after them group consciences, you know, it's a big deal to get all that stuff on. Really, where do I start? You know, it's been a real family affair for me for these last 7 days. You know, my wife's out here, my children, my mum, men that I work with, my sponsors here. You know, this thing for me, you know, CA goes so far and it reaches so many lives and touches the lives that I work with, you know, and it continues to do that, you know, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else rather than here on a Saturday night, you know what I mean, carrying the message. And it's an honour and a privilege to be asked to do this. You know, when I walked into Cocaine Anonymous about 15 years ago, and, you know, I never knew this was coming. You know, I just wanted to stop smoking crack cocaine. I just wanted to stop sniffing. I just wanted to gain a bit of control and use half a gram at the weekend. The big book talks about that. But, you know, that weren't the case, you know. Just a little bit about kind of me and how I got here and that sort of stuff. You know, I discovered cocaine at 15. And I wouldn't say it blew my mind at first because I was into a lot of LSD, cannabis, K-cider, The kind of cannabis that you smoke and it pops, you know, around the flats, passing the joint. And I took a few purpalums and that sort of stuff. And I heard about this cocaine. But what hooked me with it was the people that done it. You know, they was hanging out in nice places with the girls, driving nice cars. But my first line of cocaine was on a shitty stairwell in a council block. But what happened was that night when I took it, you know, I had a purpalum, you know, a bit of amphetamine, drinking. I remember the effect of it running down the back of my throat and the numbness. And I thought, that's all right. You know, that's good. You know, and up to that point, you know, I wouldn't say that I was racked with the spiritual malady, you know, but I was, you know, a pretty shy kid maybe. And it took all of that away. You know, it really, really, you know, give me a complete psychic change. You know, and kind of, I've left school, you know, I really struggled with my education, with reading, writing. And at that time, there was no kind of diagnosis for dyslexia or any of that stuff. And I really used to go inside myself in class. I'd be really self-obsessed, self-conscious. And they'd say, like, read to the class. And I'd be going bright red. You know, and then my mate showed me how to skin up a joint. Have a couple of tugs of that. And we walked back into that geography group like that, you know. He'd burp and all smoke come out of his mouth. And we'd just sit there stoned. And I thought, this is it. You know, this is it. You know, I left school and I was able to go on my first boys' holiday to Tenerife at 15. I've got kids now and I'd never let my kids do that. And I went to a gaff called Bobby's Bar. I don't know if anyone's been to Bobby's Bar. And rah-rahs and all that sort of stuff. And I didn't take no Class A out there. I was smoking a bit of cannabis, you know, drinking a few Budweisers. But I liked what went on in Bobby's Bar. I liked what went on in rah-rahs. And I thought, do you know what? I want a bit of that. And I come back from that Tenerife, that my first boys' holiday, and I went to my first rave called Orgasm in Bromley by Bow. And I walked into this place and it had a big pair of lips in the middle of the stage and a DJ was in the middle. And my mate went, look, I've got a pill here for you and half a gram of cocaine. And I thought, here we go. You know, prior to getting into this place, my mate was told, leave your little brother at home next time. Because I was so small walking up to the bouncers. And so I popped this pill, had a couple of lines of cocaine. And what happened for me that night, this pill come up. And I don't know if you took Doves or whatever, you know what I mean. And I remember the music pumping in this place. And it felt like everyone was in sync. And I was cuddling, we was drinking water, I was laying about and I thought, wow, this is what I've been seeking. These are my people. You know, it was kind of a fellowship that I craved at that time. You know, and for me, the E days was fucking amazing. You know, I love getting out my nut and, you know, talking to people about complete gibberish that I don't even know, you know, in clubs and all that sort of stuff. But underlining all of that, cocaine was always there. You know, and I ended up getting a job in New Bond Street working for a top solicitors up there as a messenger for these solicitors. And, you know, I was running about Mayfair for them and that sort of stuff and the law courts. And Bill talks about it and I hear it so many times. I had arrived, you know, a boy with no education, can't really read and write. You know, I can't even spell today, you know, at 40 years old. But, you know, I've the program has showed me other ways. But, you know, I was up there and I thought, this is it. This is it. You know, I'd use a month's money on a weekend's worth of cocaine because I want to be out there with them and using with them. You know, and what happened was I got so into cocaine and the effect it produced and the places it took me, you know, I started kind of running around with a few people maybe that up to other stuff. And one evening, you know, someone tried to kill me and my pal. And like any good cocaine addict, I had two lines of cocaine before going to this club. Nearly got killed, made it to the hospital, me and my friend. And all I could think about while I was getting sewn up for 8 hours, I need another line. I need another line. And I got up off this table and my mate went, you're all right, you're all right. You know, he was on the run. We had to hide him in the back of the car. My face was out there. And I said, have you got anything on you? And he just looked at me in horror. He was like, what the fuck? And I knew then that was it. You know, it was over. You know, It went on a few years. Like I'd done a few geographicals to Australia because I think you can't get cocaine out there, you know, and you can. Lots of it. You've got to search it, and I can find it. you know, and I really got into kind of amphetamine out there and got a real bad speed habit, you know, and I had to leave there in a big, up the coast, living on the street, one of them ones, heading to Tokyo with no money, you know, staying in a plot and all that sort of stuff. And by the time I got home there, you know, I didn't have no prospects at 19. And, you know, my stepdad was in construction and he was working on kind of really kind of high-end jobs in Canary Wharf, Knightsbridge and that sort of stuff. And he said, you know, if he can kind of keep his nose clean, you know what I mean? I started with me because I was labouring at that time. I'd work 7 days a week just to party for 2 days. You know, I'd give everything I had just to have that powder. You know, in between that time at 17, I tried crack cocaine. And I wasn't going to say, like, you know, it was horrifying, it was disgusting. You know, all it had done, it made me spend a month's money in one go. You know, but what it was, the craving for that drug hooked me. The fastness of it. You'd lick it and I'd be gone in 4 seconds. You know, drawling, taking my top off. You know what I mean? Trying to get another rock. And but it was on. You know, all the relationships that I had, I destroyed through my drug use. You know, because I always thought it was them. But underneath all this, there was this addiction, this relationship I had with this drug, splitting everything that I had. You know, there weren't enough hours in a week that I can get to use cocaine. You know, so I embarked on this kind of career of working in this construction game and, you know, earning quite lots of money for how young I was. You know, but this job could give me, you know, we could sniff an eighth in the morning before we go on site. We can sniff, well, we can smoke some rocks at lunchtime, if possible. You know, it kind of enabled me to use every day, 24 hours a day, you know, and it paid well. So what happened was, it just became very lonely. You know, I destroyed everything that I had. You know, there was whatever money I got, I'd work 2 days, 3 days, earn £1,500, and it'd be gone by the fourth day. You know, I could not keep up with it. And I spoke to my stepdad, you know, and a good friend of mine. He was he trains amateur boxers, and he was going to Cocaine Anonymous. And I kind of, you know, this was all secret. I had my little flat in Whitechapel. No one didn't know. I'd come out. It was like a little, you know, my front room would look really pretty. You come in a bedroom, it's like a scene at a train spotting. You know, it's fucking awful. And I said, you know, I need some help with this because I thought, you know, this non-addictive drug, cocaine, but it was ruling me, you know. And I remember my mum, when I was about 20 years old, she was taking me to a crack centre in Hackney. And I was explaining to her, you know, what crack cocaine does. And my mum, I don't know if you've seen her around the pool, but she's littler than me. And she's saying, well, your son smokes this stuff, 4 seconds, and she's horrified. But my mind would tell me, no one's supporting me, no one's looking after me. But people have been there all along. So I had my first experience with Cocaine Anonymous at 25. You know, I went to a meeting in Hackney in Tudor Grove, Mare Street, I don't know if you know it. And the fellow who was sitting there, he said, we've been waiting for you. I was like, who the fuck are these geezers? And this fella, he lives in South London, I live in East London, you know, and we don't really go over to each other's places. And him and his sponsor used to rotate this meeting with a big book. And he said, we've been waiting for you. And I sat down at that meeting and I was full of fear. You know, I tried kind of going to the drug clinics. You can have half a grand pull, 6 bottles of Budweiser. You can smoke a little bit of cannabis because you're going to be all right. I'd come out there, have 2 bottles of Budweiser, 3 bottles of Budweiser, and before I know it, I'm gone 3 days. And these people kind of spoke my language, you know. They really spoke to something in me, you know. And they sat me down, they gave me a cup of tea, gave me a cuddle, told me it was going to be all right. And that was the first time I really found this place. You know, they said, Paul, you haven't got to use like that no more. You haven't got to feel that way no more. We understand where you're coming from. Because I couldn't tell people out there that I loved what was going on for me. You know, this addiction got me so kind of isolated and alone. But what happened was, I didn't find a sponsor. I didn't take on any of the suggestions with commitments. I bought a big book because I thought it'd help all you, lovely people. And they said, Paul, you know, what happens with a lot of us in here, people that don't do this will go back. And some of us don't come back. You know, or we find we get worse, we don't get better. And I thought, fuck that, that's not going to happen to me. I thought, I can use, you know, like a gentleman now. I can buy a 16th, have a couple of pipes, a couple of snorts. It's going to be all right. My experience from that little kind of couple of years out was it was fucking horrendous. And I know now what CA done to me, it planted the seed of this, that yous really exist and yous can recover for good and for all. Relapse is not a part of this. You know, and I thought, as I was using in these crack houses, lighting up the pipe, quarters of crack cocaine everywhere, everything that I need for a good night, me and my mate staring at each other, bright, in the dark, with our pants on, lighting lighters, right, should we have another one? There we go again. Something stepped in, I believe to be God today. You know, in that house, and we was washing it up ourselves. You know, I knew how good that stuff was. Something stepped in and I said, look, I can't do this no more. And he went, you're fucking up my buzz. Leave me alone. You know how sexy it gets in there. We're both crawling about looking for specs with our pants on. Shit that I swore that I'd never do. You dropped a bit. I thought I ain't even been in the bathroom. But one thing was said to me, you know, I love my nan, you know, she's passed away now, but dear, they kind of installed some real good morals and values in me, you know, that shit is still in there. And she said, you need to be home, she's really looking forward to seeing you. And I never had the power to get out of them places. And I said to my pal, I said, tell her, I've got to go, you know, I made a commitment. But something come between me and the pipe that night. I've never smoked. That's like 15 years ago, but I've never smoked crack cocaine since. Not to say that I'd done the program at that time, but I left that place covered in ash, like I've been up a chimney, like as we do. 29 Benson on the go. Do you know, yellow fingers, yellow teeth, you know how it goes. But, and I went back home and I had a shower and I tried to gather myself and get myself right. And I had dinner, you know, eating like potatoes and you're all like this. And I went back into my mum's bedroom where I hid all the literature, the CA literature, and I put it out on the bed. And I thought, I need to go back. And I thought, but they won't have me back. Because I fucked them around. Because I was a messer by then. I'll take a 16th, an 8th, I'm going to have your money Monday morning. I'm not. You know, the phone would be flashing and I'd still be using. You know, all that, you know, all my friends and that was gone. You know, they kind of started giving me a wide berth at that point. So what happened was I used for like 18 months in my flat on my own, ringing my mate in Ireland, in Dublin, 2 o'clock in the morning. I just want to stop. And he'd be like, get yourself to a meeting, get yourself down to the doctors, you know, I just want to stop. Then I'd say, I've hid some gear around the house. And I'd be round. There's no gear hidden. It's all in my head. You know, and that went on. That went on for ages, and a good friend of mine, she was living in the south of France at the time, she rung me up and she went, what's going on? I said, Joe, I can't do it no more. I've never had thoughts of suicide or anything like that, you know, I just thought, I cannot carry on like this. And she said, you know what I'm going to do, try and get yourself to a meeting, I'm going to fly them and take you back to the fellowship. Bless that girl, you know, she's out there now. She flew home from Spain, from the south of France. And she took me to back into a meeting of NA in St. Clement's, which we know where we live is a nut ass. And I was sitting there on a Thursday night, all cockroaches running around the floor. And I just clung on for dear life. And I thought, you know what? I can't. I need to try and stay here. You know, I'd never thought I'd make it to 30 days. You know, I couldn't even pick up my newcomer chip because I was so scared. And what they said to me, Paul, just keep on coming to the meeting. Just keep on coming to the meeting. You know, I got a sponsor at that time and he didn't really explain to me about the step work. It was more kind of 90-90. You know, let's talk about it, Paul. I don't know if anyone's come off like, you know, crack cocaine and cocaine and all that sort of. My head, I was full of so much panic attacks and anxiety. You know, so I just kind of used to check in at work 15 hours a day, home shower to a meeting, check in at work 15 hours a day. You know, I really had that kind of momentum to keep going. And I made it to 30 days. At 28 days, I said to my pal, I'm going to go and use. He went, well, fucking go and use then. You're not going to beg me not to? He went, nope. Go and use. Because I still had that kind of little rebellion, you know, like, they're going to say, oh, please don't go, Paul. It's all going to be... He went, fucking go on, then. He said, but you know what? Try and get to 30 days and see how you feel after that. So I got the 30 days, and what happened at that time, I was going back to CA in Hackney, And this fella that reached out to me in that first time, he said, "Have you been through the steps?" And I was like, "No." And he said, I suggest or advise, if you don't go through these steps, you're going to go back and use." He said, "It's only a matter of time." He said, "I've seen you." And he said, "At nearly, 30 days, 60 days, you're falling apart." He said, "You may be on a bit of God's grace at the minute here." And he said, "Look, I'm willing to take you through this process if you're willing to commit to it." He said, "About any lengths." And I was like, yeah. And I thought, what the fuck's he going on about? So that big book that I had, we started on the work. You know, he spoke about the physical craving, the mental obsession, stuff that I didn't even remember when we was going through it. I was just like, yeah. But one thing what hooked me, what everyone said in their meetings that they were scared to, about a Phyllis Moore infantry. And he broke it down and he said, "Paul, this is it now. If you want to survive this, you need to write everything down in these infantries and we're going to share it together." And for me, I have trouble being honest with men and getting close with men. And sharing that with another human being really scared me. And we were sharing this infantry, and he said, "Is there anything you're going to take to the grave you're not willing to tell me?" I was like, "No, I've said it all." He said, "Is there anything you're willing to you're going to take to the grave?" He said, "Paul, this is life and death. You're going to end up using it if you keep it to yourself." And I just said it. And I thought, fuck, I can't put it back in. And he just, he said to me, "Paul, do you know what? That's all right." And he shared some experience with me. What happened to him? What went on for him? And when I left that man's house in Mottingham and I got a Docklands back to my mum's in Poplar near Canary Wharf, something was different. You know, the fifth step's promises talk about we can look the world in the eye. We'll be alone at perfect peace and ease. That what was going on. I left that man's house and I walked past all them pubs, crack houses, where I bought my gear, and it was gone. The obsession lifted that day and it's never returned in nearly 13 years. You know, so at 6 months, I went to my first convention in Memphis, Tennessee. And I didn't realise there's not a lot of white people in Memphis, Tennessee. And I'm walking down the street like this. And they're looking at me thinking, what the fuck is going on? I didn't have a clue. I flew to Chicago on my own. I'm having a cigarette outside thinking, how the fuck did I get here? I'm walking down this place and looking like to say... But what happened was that exposed me to these speakers from LA. It exposed me to kind of the solution of this big book. And I remember hanging out at that meeting, that convention all on my own. And I was sitting next to the 24-hour meeting and I could hear it going on. But I felt safe. I was in that little room. I was like watching Home Alone. Do you know, like just sitting there. And I was sitting in that little room and I felt, this is it. This is it. You know, and I met Cartoon and a few other ones and, you know, they took me, we went out and had dinner, they took me to a meeting. It was just, I just thought, this shit is just blowing my mind. And I got back from that place and we began to start up a few meetings. And, you know, and I was asked to be a secretary, I don't know how many months clean I was. And I was told, you can't do that. You can't be a secretary that clean. You know, I'd done that commitment for 18 months. And we started off at three of us, four of us. We'd get there early and read the book together. And it grew and grew and grew. You know, about a year clean time, you know, I thought, well, God's got to give me a girlfriend now. You know, I've done really well, made some financial amends. You know, and, you know, my sponsor said to me, he said, "Paul, you need a fucking relationship with yourself." You know, I didn't know who I was. You know, and my current partner, wife, you know, she rung me up, you know, after I come back from the Hackney meeting. And she said, "Look, my brother says you're clean." I was like, "Yeah. I'm a year, 12 months, or 14 months, whatever it was." I said, "Do you want to go out for coffee?" Because I thought I've got it all going on. Do you know what I mean? And we went out for coffee. I took her back to my flat and we've been with each other ever since. No. See, the old white chap, you know what I mean? And But what happened was, I thought I just had to do this stuff once. I thought that, you know, you go through this process and that's it. You know, but what happened was, I got into this relationship, you know, she had a son and we moved out. She was living in Latin at the time and I moved there with her and I thought, this is it. We've got it all fixed. But I started to come undone. I started to unfold. I started to be kind of full of rage, jealousy, that sort of stuff. Stuff that I've never ever felt before. and I didn't know why it was going on. You know, and I'd speak to people in the fellowship and say, do you feel like that? Oh, I don't know what you're talking about, bruv. I'd be like, fucking hell, what is going on for me? You know, and I went through the steps a few times again, and I was in 5 different fellowships. I was in Sex Anonymous. I've only been with one woman since I've been in recovery. But I don't know how that works out. But they was telling me to abstain from masturbation. And I'm like, what is going on here? You know, it's kind of, I'm looking for something. I'm seeking something. And a good friend of mine, Joe, he said, you don't know where the fuck you belong. He said, you know what a home group is? I was like, yeah, of course I do. He said, where are you committed to? He said, what's going on? He said, who knows where the fuck you are? You know, and at this time, he was doing some work with my current sponsor. And he said, Paul, like, you know, if you want to do a piece with me, we'll do the big book. You know, I went for a piece of work with my old sponsor, where my current sponsor and my old sponsor were sharing in Brighton. And they spoke about, you know, kind of the second part of the step one. You know, the second part, and I thought, fucking hell, that shit's hooking me. And I come back from that convention, or that weekend, that spiritual weekend, and one of them gentlemen come walking down the street in Hackney. And I said to him, I said, I hung on every word that you said. I said, I'm going through this stuff. I'm in 5 different fellowships, sex, SLA, whatever you call it. I'm in AA, I'm in CA, I'm in NA. He's like, what the fuck? He said, I don't know about any of that. He said, get a big book and let's start on the title page. I was like, ah. And he explained to me about the circle and the triangle, the 3 legacies, a service unit in recovery. And for me today, the 3 legacies is what it's all about. You know, and I went through that work with him, and I thought he put a bit of rope now in my drink when I was around there with step one. Because I started going through the steps, the first step, the first 4 chapters, and I felt I had a fucking out-of-body experience. I see some truth in that step one that has completely changed my mind. My spirit, you know, it snapped something in me, and I was like, fucking hell. He said, this is it, this is what it's about, step one experience. And something hit me, went from there to there. It talks about conceding to our innermost self, deep down within me, beyond them belief systems, beyond everything else, am I this? And he said, that's a place to start from. You know, and we looked through 2, 3, 4, 5, all that sort of stuff, you know, and I had a good few years of that, and a lot of stuff shifted, you know, and Joe showed up for me, you know, he kind of explained to me, you know, about some stuff that was going on for him, some stuff that, you know, was going on for me. He said, look, we can do a piece of work together. And I went to his house in Brighton, and we'd done a multiple 5th step after we went through the steps, and it completely blew my mind, because there was 4 of us sitting there with all bits of paper, and we held each other accountable on what we were saying. And there was no judgment. There was no aggression. We just listened. And we wrote a defect. And we shared it with each other. And I left that in Brighton. And I thought, this is what I want. You know, the big book talks about 7 people to share a 5th step with. You know, I'll share a bit more about that. But, you know, it completely revolutionised what I was doing in CA. Then I began to read some stuff about the history of AA and what it looked like and how the Al-Anons used to go through the big book. But that only stopped about a few years ago. How everyone, you know, how this way of living is for all of us and our families. You know, how they can have all of this. So I went back to where I was living and I started to get lit up. You know, I really started to get into this. I really, you know, I was fed up with that kind of, like, that rocking chair recovery. I was all right 1 minute, I was shit next. I'd be full of fucking self-loathing the next. I'd be full of fear, anxiety. I started to level, you know, and he began to show me some stuff around 10, 11. You know, I began to complete all my amends, you know, but sad to say, Joe picked up. You know, Joe picked up. And he says to me, Paul, he said, I can't work with you no more. He said, but I'm going to speak to my sponsor, Mike. And he said, he'll see if he'll take you on and we'll do the piece of work with you. Because I was hungry for it. Once you get this, once I got this, I want more of it. And as Matt shared, you know, a couple of men that I work with kicked this thing off this weekend. You know, I have to mine this stuff all the time. And I get so much back by giving it away. This is the only thing that works when I'm in trouble, is working with another addict or an alcoholic. What I love about CA, we're all welcome. You know, I went to AA meetings, and Matt laughed because I said I'm an alcoholic. He goes, no, you fucking ain't.
He says, I know you're not. He says, you don't drink alcohol like me. But I sniff cocaine and smoke cocaine.
You know, and what this is what I love about this, you know, the men and women I work with, we're a mixed bunch. You know, we've got some alkies, we've got some druggies, we've got some whatever. You know, we're all welcome. And this is what I love. You know, so really my journey, you know, started again with Mike, and we went through that process, and I got lit up with that first step again. You know, in the 12 and 12, it talks about, you know, if there's one step that we must try and get 100% right, that's the first step. You know, everything else can be a little bit, but it's the first step. And for me, that first step keeps me locked into this. It keeps me coming out to these places, because I know when I'm asked, I've got to go. You know, I was having a laugh with Ben before we started. He said, you're fucking everywhere. But I know it's my duty to go and do this now, and it's a fucking honour. You know, it really is. You know, so we went through the step one and blown away. Again, that step changes for me all the time. You know, I do step one when I go back through that process and putting everything aside. Sometimes I can taste crack cocaine in the back of my mouth. Sometimes I can feel cocaine up my nose. Looking at step one, I haven't used that drug for nearly 13 years, and it's there. Because the problem centres in my mind rather than my body. And I don't know what a mental obsession looks like. There's not a cloud on the horizon it talks about. You know, I could be driving down to Portable News tomorrow morning, and I think, do you know what, let me just get half a gram. Carla, the kids, my mum, yous, ain't going to stop me. I can't just talk it through. Because I don't know what it looks like. You know, and it talks about if it comes in, how to explain it in a book, and I love the literature of the book. It's hazy. They can't think for it. You know, all sane thinking is gone. And it says, we're going to do it again. And I know this physical craving, if I was to sit off, still exists with me at nearly 13 years clean. If I was just to have one tonight, I'd be gone again, 3 days. You know, and I used to work, I don't know how many hours a week, a 6-day week to use for 3 days. And that is fucking painful. You know, that's how it got in the end. 15 hours a day, 17 hours a day, just to binge for 3 days. And that hurts. Because you're waking up Monday morning saying, can I just lend 20 quid to get back? It ripped my soul. It completely ripped my soul. And kind of going through this process and looking at current agnosticism. Where am I at? With them 7 questions on 45. Is lack of power my dilemma? It doesn't matter how many years in recovery. I know a gentleman that's picked up a 30 years sober on his 30th clean birthday. And that shit scares me. You know, and is that 10 or 5? You know, so I know I've got to be serious about this stuff, and I'm going to kind of wrap all this up now in 10 minutes. So before, I was a bit on the fence about amends. It ain't their money, it's my money. And I was told, you're not giving back your money, you're giving back their fucking money. You know, it's a bit of a hard kind of conception to come round to. But when I was willing to go back to put that stuff right, you get it back. You get time, money, peace, happiness. Because my role is to be of maximum service to God and others. And I really get to see that in the third step to have a new employer. You know, I really need to be convinced of the ABCs. Because I speak to a lot of people, I say, you convinced of them ABCs? They look at me like I've just spoke Swahili. Are you convinced? Are you convinced your life on a self-will would never be a success? Because I know men of wealth are locked up in a bedsit because they can't come out because of the pipe. Because they put everything else in front of this. It doesn't matter what you got, it will take it. And it likes it. Because there's always that part of my mind that say, if I just get this, it'll be all right. If I just get that, it'll be all right. But the book is clear on it. Your selfishness is going to kill you, Paul. You know, the book is full of so many beautiful promises. But there's loads of death threats in that book. It tells me not crack cocaine is the number one offender, Paul, in your life. Resentment. It destroys more than us than anything else. Harbouring that stuff for years. Twisting me up and turning me away from God. I can't get to spirit when I'm like that. You know, and for me, when I was going through the sex, like, you know, I've had one partner since I've been in. But going through that sex ideal and the sex inventory and looking at it in relationships with my family, you know, my relationship with God, and putting a sane and sound ideal together, how I want to grow and what do I want. You know, when I was here a couple of years ago, you know, I lost everything. My house was gone. Everything we owned was gone within 20 minutes. You know, I come back 2 years later, our house is back. We got married in the summer. Do you know, our kids are all right. The dog's still alive, thank God. But she's a bit blind, but she's all right. But you know, what I've got down with over this time, you know, of these kind of rocky roads and all that sort of stuff, I began to embark on meditation. I began to embark in, you look at the step nine, kindness, patience, and tolerance and love it talks about in our morning meditation with our family. You know, it talks about the sick man or woman is like a forgiveness prayer. You know, and that's where I really begin to take my power back. That's really the bridge to the shore for me. Because I go from that third column, being all that and all this and that. And it says, Paul, no, you know what? This inventory is yawn. It's nothing to do with any other fucker. You resolutely, with determination, look at your mistakes. This is your stuff. And what amazing thing is, no one has to change for me to be all right tonight. I have to do the deal. I have to do the work. Because the price will be paid. You know, I've seen so many from a couple of years ago that are gone. You know, I don't know who's going to be here in the next couple of years. Because once it comes, it comes. Once I think I ain't paying that little bit of money back, it says I have to face the most ruthless creditor, or I'm liable to drink again. Is my sex conduct selfish or not? Because you will drink again. Clear cut direction of men and women that have walked before us. You know, and you look at the traditions and how you can live your life by them. You know, it talks about our common welfare should come first, but also our individual common welfare of each other, taking care of each other, not bitching about him when his back's turned. You know, asking him, are you all right? And really meaning it. Inviting you into my home to meet my wife and my children and have some dinner and talk about spirituality. You know, it talks about there's 12 prayers, 12 meditations and 12 visions in 10 and 11 from step 9. Stuff that we can break down and live our life by and make a whole new conception of God to grow how we want to be. You know, no one ever give me that in a counselling room. Is it because your mum didn't love you? No, what the fuck? Is it because your dad left when you was three? You know, people sit here, you know, people that kind of show us how to grow a vision. You know, my life is not one bit the same as it was when I walked in to these rooms. You know, it keeps on evolving and growing. And if you are bored and stagnant, find someone that's doing the deal. Ask them, what are they doing? Why the fuck are you lit up? What's going on? You know, because I got quiet and I got scared and I thought, I can't talk to these people. But there's people that have got around me that hold me accountable. You know, what's up, Paul? What's going on? Stuff that I can talk about most intimately. And they won't judge me. They won't laugh at me. They have my back 24 hours a day. I never had that out there in the crack house. Really want to know how I am and my family are. And from that, how long have we got? I don't know. Yeah, so just kind of wrap all this down. You know, looking at this vision stuff and doing this work, you know, I was able to work with a lot of men and women. I don't know, about 2,000 foot maybe. A couple, you know, and these people are coming into my life, and I'm going to just, you know, I've been working with a lifer in Brixton Prison. And this man thought he was never getting out. And we have 5 minutes every weekend to do some work with each other. So I get the work ready. He shares his bit. I share my bit. The phones go. They listen to our conversation talking about God and spirit and all that sort of stuff. And he's moved to an open prison. But he's in the process of amends. And he's got two daughters that he's never seen. And I said to him, Dan, you've just got to kind of visualise yourself going back to them, as I've been shown. Visualise going back to them and ask, are you willing to do whatever it takes to put this right? His daughter had a dream. And she said, Dad, I'm only answering this because you come to me in a dream and ask forgiveness. And he was locked in a cell 23 hours a day. And she said, Dad, I'm willing to take this amends. And I want to tell you, you've got a granddaughter. And Dad, do you know what? I'm going to explain to Mum what you're doing and we're willing to take this. He hasn't seen his children for years. But what happened was this man was locked away and never getting out. They've just moved into an open prison. We've had this relationship for 18 months. We've never seen each other. It's like a pen pal. We don't know what we look like. He's running. We went to the rap reunion. And he said, what you look like? I said, I'm really tall with long hair. Just for the recording, I am. So I've got down to this church, Spitalfields Church, and Spirit tells me that's him. And he's like that. I said, Dan. And we looked at each other. And this is just the power of this thing. Seeing Matt's life come alive, Nikki's life. You know, there's so many things. There ain't enough time to share them. But there's so much stuff. Once you get hooked into this, the real part of this book and the literature, not the moody little bit that talks about this and that, and you can swerve a little bit of that. No, the real depth of this work. You know, because this is truly God-given and inspired to me. You know, I didn't come in here looking for religion. I didn't even come in here looking for God. I just want to get the crack pipe and then fucking straw out of my nose. And it's given me so much more. So I'm going to wind it down now. I just want to say a little bit about my sponsor, because he's looked after me for nearly 6 years. He's going to share after me tonight. You know, as I said, you know, we lost a brother that we both love really back out. I don't know if he's back in, but Mike has been continuously there, showing and growing and being there for me. You know, he stayed over. The kids thought he was dead in bed because he was so jet-lagged.
Carla's going to me, see if he's alive. She's alive. I'm like, he's breathing, Carl.
But, you know, he's come into our lives and he's, you know, he might say, have you fucking married that girl yet? Have you fucking married that girl? Because it's about union. It's about cultivating this relationship. He's never, ever said to me, you need to believe this way, you need to do this way. Ring me at 7 o'clock. That's all it is. Watch my feet. Watch your feet. You know, carry on doing this work. You know, and we were sitting there and he says to me, you come in shorts. You're supposed to be representing CA. So I got all self-conscious while I was tucking into my cake thinking, fucking hell, and the pink. Do you know what I mean? But you know, I know it's about action. It ain't about the pink shorts. You know, with that, I'd like to hand it over to Mike D.
Opportunity for a bathroom break.
Oh, they're taking a break?
Oh, just to probably...
No break.
They're probably just going for the...
Alrighty. I'm an addict. My name's Mike D. I'd like to first thank my God for today. I greet you with the magical word peace. And let peace be multiplied among you. Thank you, Paul, Matt, Simon. Is Simon here? Simon, T. I'd like to do something. I'd like anybody that I've done a piece of work with, whether you completed it or not, to stand up. Anybody. T. Anybody? Stand up. Adrian left. Some of you guys got sponsees here. Tell your sponsees to stand up. Then I got some friends here. Danny. Stand up, Danny. Where's Kev? Kev left. Kevin, John just walked in and made my night. Colin, stand up. Colin. And I got my honey with me, my fiance. Stand up, Ellen. I'd like to say thank you. I'd like to say thank you for being my friends, for accepting me just like I am. That's a big deal. I want to thank you for my life. Without you, I would not be standing here tonight. Without you, God is a whole nother deal without you. And to look around the room and see what's happened as a result of me and Heron being partners for a very long time, it's amazing. It's amazing. You guys can sit down. Thank you. First deal is that I feel underdressed, so I'm going to take off some of this stuff. Will told me, I said, so should I dress? He said, yeah. He said, wear a suit and a tie. I'll be damned if only me and T is the only one in here in a tie. So I'm going to loosen up a little bit. It's an honor to be here tonight. It's an honor to be able to say my sobriety date is March 9th, 1987. That Heron hasn't physically had its way with me in 30 years. It's attacked me mentally and spiritually, but physically, I haven't taken that next step, which is stick a spike in my neck or in my pinky or in my toe or in the palm of my hand. That as a result of what we do in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous, something happened for me. And I'm here tonight to talk to someone. I don't know who you are. Me and T did a workshop today, and we had some people come up to us and thank us for what we talked about. If he's like me, he never knows who he's going to touch. I never know who I'm going to touch. But I've been doing this long enough to know that somebody's going to be touched. It's my job. I've been anointed. Somebody has equated that with religion. It's not about religion. It's about being a child of the King. It's about being the son of an almighty God. And he positioned me to do just this and nothing less. He's positioned me to stand in the midst of the storm. How does a poor black African-American boy growing up in the 60s and 70s of segregated New York City in a little country called Harlem make it to a room like this? Tell me. How does a young African-American, poor, struggling out of a family that struggled, being taught by black Muslims and being taught by segregation, get to make it to a room like this with no judgment? I have an answer, but the answer is not appropriate and does not and tell really what's going on here. Because there's something that's going on here that's unseen. You can't see it. He moves in between the spaces. He'll give you a glimpse. Spirit will give you a glimpse out of the side of your eye, and that's it. It's too powerful for you to face head on. And you begin to feel really what we do here. So, like I just did, I had those people stand up because I love them, man. I got some people today that actually like to see me coming. They don't judge me. They know I'm not perfect. They give me space to be human. But in all that, they love me. So you may not get a chance to do this again, because the reality of what's going on here is that the second this deal is over, you could walk out of here and get in your car and have a head-on collision that can kill you physically. So I don't know if you get the opportunity and how often you get to do this, but I want you to do it tonight. I want you to get up. I want you to go to somebody that you don't know. I want you to give them a hug and tell them, I love you. I am glad that you're here. Get up. Get up. Get up. So my honey is going to love all of y'all, so y'all better get ready. She's just going to keep walking. Kev, you left the room, man, but I want to tell you I love you, bro. I haven't forgot you. Haven't forgot. I've been blessed. And I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I never know what I'm going to talk about. I just pray and ask God to direct me and guide me and speak through me and help me to be an instrument for him. I am thoroughly convinced, that's the only reason why I've been kept alive. I'm thoroughly convinced that this is no longer about me. I'm thoroughly convinced that the agenda that must adorn my life is you. That's it. That came to me many years ago. As a result of that, I'm put in a category of some people like me and some people hate me because of what I say. Because I don't bite my tongue. Those of you that know me know I don't change. I will tell you the truth. I will be totally upfront and honest with you. And that's come from an upbringing in recovery, but it's also come from an upbringing in the street. I didn't lose everything that was given to me when I got to Cocaine Anonymous in recovery. Some of that stuff I learned in that concrete and pavement in those streets of Harlem, New York, and New York and New York City, I didn't lose. It's aided me and helped me to get to this place in my life in this precise moment. I don't negate it. I embrace it. And I tell you about it. So I'm just grateful that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And that I got ready a very long time ago. That last treatment program that I went into in 1987, I didn't know I was ready. God knew I was ready. That treatment center that opened its doors to me because I had another court case and I knew I was going to penitentiary, and if I didn't do something, I would probably be in there for a very long time. God knew I was ready for a change of life. He knew I was ready to embrace what had been given to me some 15, 20 years earlier, when I was nurtured and I was groomed and I was set up to live a spiritual life as a messenger for him, raised in a family very spiritual, raised by three women that were God-fearing and Jesus God-loving. Placed in an arena where I was seated, they began to drop pearls of wisdom on me that they knew would stick, because in their infinite wisdom, they knew there would come a day when I would need that stuff. And they probably knew it because of the time and the era and the part of the country that I grew up in the United States. Very hard back in the 60s. Very hard, very calculated. If you want to get an idea of who I was, watch the movie American Gangster. Cold, no love, no caring, no understanding. Get the money, get the women, fast money, all the outside stuff with no nurturing and building on the inside. And I took it on as a way of life. And I liked it. It's something about that lifestyle that attracts you. And it holds your attention. And that's exactly what I did. Growing up the youngest of five brothers, oldest brother gangster. The day he died from cancer, cirrhosis of the liver, hepatitis C, with a pistol under his pillow. Brother next to him, an evangelist, spiritual man. Brother next to him, philosopher, painter, sculptor, artist, cultured. Brother next to him, a doo-wop, lover boy, pretty boy. Never got the opportunity until I got to you guys to find out my identity and who I was. I took pieces of each one of them and applied them to me as my identity and wanted to be like them. Almost killed me. The grace of God sustained me. The love of God catapulted me into a mindset of I have to have help. Something has got to change here. I need an evolution in my mind and my body and my spirit. Something woke up in me in that last treatment center. To the point of I became willing to do what I did for Heron. I became willing to do the same thing and go to the same lengths for my life. And it's magical. I don't know about what you use, crack cocaine or methamphetamine or pills or sex or gambling or whatever. There's something possibly, and it's for you to identify in your life or that was in your life that was magical. It created miracles for you. It began to do for you what you could not do for yourself. It began to give you a feeling deep down inside that nothing else on the planet could give you. And you begin to cultivate a love affair with that something. Going to any lengths for that something. Selling people down the river for that something. Setting people up for that something. It was your master. At the age of 16, when I met Heron, physically met Heron, I had sold it for a number of years by the age of 16. But when I physically began to ingest it at the age of 16, something happened that was magical. I'll never forget it. Didn't do for me what alcohol did. Didn't fix me the way alcohol did. Fixed me on a greater level than alcohol or reefer, who Paul was calling the shit cannabis. Reefer. Cocaine. Love cocaine. Grew up in the era where when I was hustling, I would sniff cocaine, and when I got strung out, I would straight mainline cocaine. But love cocaine to a certain extent. Don't let me get too high, and then I got to get down, man. Don't want to hear those bells. So what was the equalizer for me? The equalizer was Heron. In some of the episodes, the stuff that you guys talk about with your relationship with cocaine, I can identify on a certain level, but only on a certain level. I can remember shooting straight cocaine and jacking it off, and I had a baseball bat that I kept in the living room. And I'd jack it off, and I'd go grab the baseball bat and stand in the middle of the living room floor and hold it up and start yelling, "You motherfuckers, come on. I know you out there." Twisted. But I had the power to put cocaine down. In my young years of when I met alcohol, ages 11, 12 to 15, I had a couple of drunks, no blackouts. I was able to control and manage the amount of alcohol that I drank. Didn't like the feeling produced, the effect of it. I'm trying to establish for somebody, I don't know who you are, a foundation for you to stand on because your recovery is rocky. And your recovery is rocky because you don't know your truth. The majority of people are either alcoholic or addict. They're not both. Dollar to a donut. When you sit down with somebody that's properly armed with facts about themselves and facts about the disease, they will help you get to a bottom for you to nail what your truth is. As a result of that happening for me in the 1980s, late 80s, I found Cocaine Anonymous coming out of that treatment program. Cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. Heron addict. I crave heron. I love the effect produced by heron. I can take it or leave cocaine. I can take or leave alcohol. I can take or leave pills. I can take or leave weed. Can't take or leave alcohol. I mean heron. It always brought me to the brink of near destruction. I didn't totally destruct because I'm standing with you here tonight. But I had to see my truth on a level that's not really talked about in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. The depths of the first step. The depths of really, what are you doing here? as far as allergy, physical, mental, obsession. What is it that your body physically craves? That you might start out with one thing, but sooner or later you end up with this thing that you've ended up with for God knows how long. What is it? I don't know about you guys, man, but when I was in the street, I didn't hang out with crackheads. I hung out with heroin addicts. I didn't hang out with alcoholics. I hung out with dope fiends and junkies, they used to call them back in the day. Same thing needs to happen for our new friends and old friends that still don't know their truth. They're surviving on the grace of God, the fringes of the program as to what really happens here. You wonder why your life hasn't taken off, probably because your foundation isn't solid. You get peace and comfort from doing the stuff outside of here, and you haven't even tapped the inside of really what's going on with you. Powerful deal when I was exposed to that. Powerful deal when I found out I had cultivated a love affair with Heron. More powerful than any other relationship I ever had in my life. More powerful than two marriages, more powerful than the love I had for four brothers, where the five of us were like this, more powerful than the love I had for a mother. Somebody talked about their 19-year-old mother that bore them, loved me, 9 years between me and my brother next to me. And my father left, and he did what a lot of us do. We think we own women, so we got the privilege to creep when we want to. And Mama got pregnant and wouldn't get rid of me. And she had me and raised me by herself with my grandmother and my godmother and loved me. In my coming up, I didn't think she loved me because of what she did. Very strict upbringing, rebelled at the age of 12. It's only been a couple years that I was brought to light with that whole relationship. I had made amends to my mother years ago. I had to go back and make amends to her again and tell her, thank you for loving me the way that you did. I understand now. You did the best you could do with what you had. That's the way you knew how to love. The auspices of this program and what we do here begins to take effect and begins to hold anchor deep down within me, and smidgens and kibbles is not enough. Being a crumb snatcher is not enough. I get a thirst for more. I get a yearning for more. I get a glimpse of what God can really do. Why? Because I see it in other people, what's happened with them in their recovery and how they've been catapulted into another dimension, and something inside of me screams for that. I want that. And not only do I want it, I need it because I'm miserable. Years under my belt, I'm miserable. Completed the steps a number of times, and I'm miserable. People don't want me around, and I'm miserable. Something's wrong. So as a result of that treatment program and those 14 months of staying stopped, something happened, and I became willing. I only became willing to do one thing, though, and that was go to meetings. Go to meetings and sit still. I knew something was wrong. I didn't know exactly what was wrong, but I knew something was wrong. And by the age of 37, I was tired. I don't know if you're a mad dog like me. I chased Heron with every inch of my being. Every ounce of me was about getting loaded. Didn't care nothing about you. I gotta have mine. Don't get in the way. I gotta have mine. I am so grateful that same attitude and that same positioning followed me into the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. And God knew what I needed. Never OD'd off of heroin. My brother next to me was a heroin addict, OD'd, died 1981. The one that was 9 years older than me. 41 years old, I knew by the time I was 40 I'd be dead because I ran twice as hard as him. Lived pavement and concrete twice as hard as he did. A lie that was smashed as a result of you people. Those of you that carry a message that got some depth and some weight, that's about reaching your hand out and saying, here I am, how can I help you? How can I be of service to you? Got my first sponsor, my first Eskimo in 1988. Hasn't stopped since. I'm going to say it again. How does a black African-American male who's an endangered species get to stand in Malaga, Spain? Poor. On my own, I wouldn't have never made it here. In high school, I had aspirations. I took French in high school, and I had aspirations to go to Paris. Dropped out of high school in 11th grade. Never finished. Wanted to go to Paris because the French teacher was fine. Fine as all get out. So I want to go to Paris. Heron took control of my life, seized me, and would not let me go. And as a result of 20-some years of hardcore heroin addiction, I knew my destiny was death. Heron addiction, street life, concrete and pavement, pistols, all that crazy, insane living. I knew I was dying. Thank God for what we do in the nucleus of this program. Thank God for those of us that come into meetings and speak from podiums that talk about really what we do. That we don't want you to get a Band-Aid. We want you to get a solution. We want you to know that transparency is the key to freedom. We want you to know that one alcoholic or one addict sharing with another alcoholic or another addict is a key to freedom. We want you to know that steps 4 through 9 ain't no joke. You complete 4 through 9 in turning your life and your will over to the care of God. Watch him show up in 10, 11, and 12. The milk and honey of what we do. I dare you. Somebody's sitting here tonight wondering why my life is so fucked up. Because you won't do nothing. You won't do nothing. You want to be a prima donna. You want to be Mr. Handsome. You want people to like you. And it's killing you. Because you've been around us for a while and it ain't working no more. It's only God that's giving you a red flag. That's all it is. My restless, irritable, discontent, twisted, malnourished spirit is only a red flag. God doing what he said he'd do. He said, I'll take care of you. You're my son. He said, I'll be your father. So he gives you red flags, but you ain't heeding. You're still running on self. You still put more value in out here than you do in here. This program has taught me how to love myself. This program of Cocaine Anonymous has taught me how to love you. This program of Cocaine Anonymous in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to reach my hand out and say, help me. This program of Cocaine Anonymous has taught me how to say, I'm hurting. Is anybody listening? Can anybody hear me? I'm hurting. And you see, the connection here is not always through words. You look in somebody's eyes and in somebody's face and you see the unmanageability running rampant. You see it. And then those of us that are here connected for real, we pass in passing ships in the night and our spirits connect and you feel it. And you know he's hurting. She's hurting. She's putting up a good show, a good fight, man, but spirit recognizes spirit. And I begin to tap into really what happens here. People don't like these kind of talks. They used to come into conventions and banquets and they want to make you laugh. And they want to tell you jokes. I want to touch your spirit. I want you to know that there's a God that's alive and well that will catapult you to infinite possibilities. He did it for me. He did it for me. Little black boy from the streets of Harlem, New York, standing in Malaga, Spain for the fifth time. That wanting to go to Paris. Been to Paris 5 times. I could go on and on and on. But like I said, when I come, I just talk, man. I don't know who I'm talking to, but I've been doing this long enough to know I'm talking to somebody. You just like me, where you grew up might not be Harlem, New York, but it's a Harlem, New York. Everybody in here ain't got a bunch of money. You might look like it, but you ain't got a bunch. Don't get it twisted and bamboozled. We got a program in the program. I call it the club in the club. I call it God's healing space, where he begins to heal every single part of me that is out of alignment with who he would have me be. He did not keep you alive for nothing. And the perpetuation of your suffering is perpetuated by you. Nobody and nothing else. Paul talked about that fourth column in inventory. Where you do all that writing, and then they say, okay, good deal, but it ain't about them. Let's get to the root of what you suffer from. Selfish, self-centered, egotistical individual. Grandmother tried to steer me in the right direction, thought she was mean, the meanest person on the face of this earth. So to get back at her at a very young age, I had to be about five or six, I knelt down in a corner in the hallway where we grew up in on 112th Street, and I tried to cut her leg with a can opener to show her who's boss. So much that's been showed to me about my thinking. And the way I act my thinking out, that if it does not change, I will die. Might not be 6 feet under, but I'll be sitting in here a dead man. I'll be doing 90 and 90 and dead. My truth. They ask you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I don't know about all that. And I'm a big book guy. I just know I pray and ask God to direct me, speak through me, and I drop it. That's it. Somebody in here tonight, you need to do some work. You need to stop saying, I ain't getting no goddamn sponsor. I don't want nobody telling me what to do, and get a sponsor. Somebody in here, I'm going to do a meeting a week. You probably need to be doing 2, 3, 4 a week. You probably need to be taking inventories because you need a spiritual guide. Probably need to write inventory to face, to be rid of some things that are blocking you from God. And then you probably need to be catapulted into step 9 at the ultimate surrender to fit yourself to be of maximum service to God and the people about you. Until you do that, your life ain't never going to change. You're going to stay on a vicious roller coaster. Vicious merry-go-round. You'll get free for a minute, but you'll never get what it needs to sustain your peace. You'll never get it. So I'm off on another trek through the 12 steps. Umpteenth time. In step 9 again, about to make some amends. I love that step. That's what freed me in my first piece of work, my 9th step, because I had some horrific amends. I had amends by all rights. They could have killed me. They could have took my life because of what I did to them. They took my life because of the sums of money I owed 2 different groups of people. The mother of my children didn't have to accept me back in their life. My family didn't have to open the door to me again. Because I was a motherfucker. All that and more has happened for my life. To the point of my family don't quite understand. They don't quite understand. You know, once you get on this road and you become who you become for God, you're going to have to shed some people. You're going to have to let them go. Or either they'll remove themselves because it'll be too much for them. I've had to do that. I've had to let a grown son and a younger daughter, I've had to let them go. I had to realize that Mike Jr. is going to be Mike Jr. I can't save him and I can't fix him. All I can continue to do is be that light, that beacon for him. That's it. Give him to God and move on with my life. So we got something for you here, ladies and gentlemen. We got a way of life that's indescribably delicious. Taste it, for real. Don't just come to our conventions to just hang out and socialize. And this is a social event, but what's in the nucleus of what we do here? If you sat in a couple of the shears that I sat in since we started on Friday night, my spirit got fed, man. I'm here for very specific reasons. I become malnourished still. At 30 years, my spirit gets malnourished. I need it fed. I thank those individuals that are in my lineage because they feed my spirit. They help God do for me what I can't do for myself. I've shared it with them. My Skyping with them once a week, going through the work with them once a week, is just as much for me as it is for them. I need you. I need you to love me. I need you to care about me. I need you to be unconditional with me. The same way I am with you. Love your neighbor as yourself. Real basic teachings that we've all heard all through our lives. To know me is to know God. God is not outside of me. I've been formed and shaped in the image of God. I don't care where you're from, what color you are, how much you're plugged in, how much you're not plugged in, you're shaped in the image of God. He wants the best for you. You suffer because that's what you want for you. You're restless, irritable, and discontent because you've made the choice to be restless, irritable, and discontent. There's a whole new world that waits for you. It's the world of the recovered alcoholic and the recovered addict. The obsession and the allergy, the physical and the mental, are no longer my business. I get to walk a free man or a free woman in this world. I get to see how I can be of use to other people. I get to be an instrument. And then he touches us with special gifts. That's another layer. Because whether you know it or not, sponsors are healers. They heal people. As a result of God having healed them, and then give them the power to heal people through their words and their direction. You got to ask yourself, do you want that? And I could go on and on and on with the spiritual aspect of this program because that's an avenue that I live in. But I'll keep it to the basis of what we do here. We need to tell our young friends when they come to see us, don't fuck around. Get a sponsor, do some work. Get a commitment, find a home group. Begin to cultivate and create the fellowship that you crave, same way you did in the street. Begin to surround yourself with like-minded people. Begin to cultivate a love affair with God. Find out if you're a real one or not. If you're a real one, you don't have no options. Ain't no soft and easy way for you. I'm looking forward to seeing what God has got for me in this ninth step I've entered into again. Fitting myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. I'm engaged to my lovely honey, about to be married in December. As a result of my last marriage, I said I wasn't marrying nobody. Nobody. I am not doing it again. That's proof for me that I don't know what God's plan for me is. But when he begins to reveal his plan to me, am I willing to embrace it? And what happened was that when I looked up and saw the hookup, I saw it was a perfect fit. It was God-inspired, for real. Everybody can't do that because a lot of you don't live on a spiritual basis. You haven't invited that piece of the program into your life. Invite that piece of the program into your life. Bill doesn't talk about it just to be talking about it. He doesn't tell us that he was catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence. Bill was a real alcoholic. Bill finally became convinced on a thorough level that he needed God in order to not drink again. Tenth step doesn't say we've entered the world of the Spirit just to use it as a phrase and a statement. It actually tells us, as a result of 1 through 9, something should have happened by now. There's a realization that there's someplace else that you need to live in order for you to have peace, serenity, comfort, mastering resentment, looking fear in the eye. Something should have happened by now. You need to be learning how to live in God's world, spirit world. Whole nother talk. Whole nother fellowship. Spirit world. And I get to see the glory of God. I get to see exactly what he will do for a guy like me. You'll get to see what he'll do for a woman like you. No matter what's going on out here. And some of us, we're okay out here. We don't want for nothing. We don't need nothing. If we want something, we can get it or go to somebody and they'll give it to us. For me, it's about in here. It's in here. Way deep in the midnight hour when it ain't nobody around. And Heron starts kicking his heels and wants to pick a fight. What do you do with it? It's about the job that you're on and you're miserable doing what you're doing, but you get up every morning and you go to work. Does that make any sense? It's about the marriage that you're in and you don't want to be in it no more, but you don't have the power to get out of it. You don't have the power to get out of it and you don't have the power to stay in it. You're just there. Does it make any sense to live that way? It's about being stuck in the fact that people, places, and things must be the way you know they are to be in order for you to be okay. And they might not never change. That mother might not never change. That husband might not never change. That child might not never change. What are you going to do? Suffer? If you are, that's your choice. So I'm just grateful. I'm just grateful that 30 years later, I still do what I did at 2 years, 3 years clean. Still go to meetings. Got three sponsors, female sponsor for you females, because I don't know nothing about you still, very little. I've learned a few things, huh, honey? A few things. Some days, right? Yeah. Gotten a little bit better at that. Got a spiritual sponsor, because 10 Steps says we've entered the world of the Spirit. So that's a practice for me, spirit world living. And then I got Mr. C. Phenomenal. Phenomenal. I go to him with my stuff, and all he says to me is, "So where's God in all that, Mike?" Brings me back to center that God is either everything or he's nothing. And even in the nothingness, there is God. And I get free. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me out. To be quite honest, I really didn't want to come. I wasn't going to come. Y'all know Will can be a motherfucker, right? Y'all know that, right? Right. He was like, "You got to be there, Mike." Got a whole bunch of stuff going on. Work in Austin, Texas as a director of spiritual development for a treatment program. New fiance just moved back to Las Vegas, trying to set up our new house. Trying to open this chapter to this next chapter of my life. But I'm glad I came. Because I saw some friends. I met some of my friends here. That's all I live for today. Just let me hook up with my friends. Sometimes your friends will love you more than your family does. This is the fellowship that I crave. Thanks for letting me share.